All right, next, let's talk about profit displacement. What good does it do to master the new patient and production displacement challenge if you don't get to keep any of this revenue for yourself? See, when a doctor does manage to increase new patients in production, there's some fairly predictable pitfalls related to lost profitability that they're likely to encounter. That's what I want to look at now. We found that there's four main causes of failed profitability when new patients and monthly production actually do increase. They are as follows. Number one, poor case development. It's either capacity-based or presentation-based. Number two, under-expansion. Number three, diminishing returns. And number four, team productivity. All right, let's look first at case development. I compare this one to the way the human body gains weight. You know, if you're over 25, you've probably fought the dieting wars at some point in your life. One of the things that frustrates many dieters and people who would like to change the appearance of their bodies is that they tend to gain weight fairly evenly over their entire body all at once. That means if you're going to get rid of your waistline, you have to lose a lot of weight before you'll see any shrinkage in this offending area. It's the same when you try to add patients and production to a practice. Unless the entire practice organism expands equally, you'll see more patients with no noticeable improvement in your bottom line. If you see 10 additional new patients in a given month, unless everything from the doctor's speed to the staff-to-patient ratios are improved, you're going to find that your production per case goes down proportionally to the increase in new patients. I've actually seen doctors add as many as 50 new patients, that is, additional new patients per month, only to see their production stayed the same at the end of that month. They were abbreviating their patient encounters and unconsciously giving patients assignments that the patients could not possibly fulfill. For example, they would tell patients the importance of committing to multiple appointments that literally were unavailable. They would slowly morph from treating patients into just dispensing palliative patchwork. Many of them find themselves unconsciously refusing to show needed work to patients because there's no room on the schedule to do more than the bare minimum of treatment. I know you may be thinking that what I'm really discussing here should have been included under displacement category number two, more new patients, same production. I know you thought this was going to be a discussion about more production, same profit. Well, what happens if you do increase new patients at the cost of paid advertising, and then you start this process I'm describing of underdeveloping your cases? At the very least, you're out the cost of the advertising and whatever else you spent to accommodate the increased new patient flow. You see, profits can easily be negatively affected if you don't advance on all fronts. That leads us to profit killer number two, under-expansion. Under-expansion is not caused by a doctor's unwillingness to expand. In fact, he or she may have made an impressive and costly improvement to many parts of the clinic. Under-expansion is the result of leaving any critical area of a practice unimproved or underimproved. For example, you've taken care of the obvious high-risk aspects of clinic expansion. You know, you've bought a building at the cost of $1.5 million and fixed it up. You equipped it with the best of everything, but you failed to remove a negative, underproductive staff person who was at the front desk. You see, even if the doctor does go faster and space gets bigger, it only takes one small rope still tied to the dock to keep this big ship from going anywhere. All right, the third category of profit limiter is diminishing returns. When I use this term, I'm referring to the crossing of a very specific balance point. You see, you eventually reach a point where you can't sustainably process a larger patient volume without adding an additional staff person. Unfortunately, there comes a point where you won't be able to find a place for that additional staff person to sit in your existing clinic. I've personally evaluated clinics where I had to interview staff sitting in hallways of the common area of the building, on folding chairs, or even on the floor. There wasn't even a closet in the practice where I could stand and interview someone. When this happens, you have to consider adding space, and that's where it gets costly. There may not be anywhere to go with an internal expansion. When this happens, the cost of an additional staff person, that is, adding a staff person, can run well over $1 million. I just talked to a doctor this week. His expansion is $1.9 million, all because he needs one more staff person and there's nowhere to put them. You see, this is the diminishing returns tipping point. So what do you do when you're facing such a profitability drop-off? This is a conscious or unconscious turning point for many doctors. When they see out of their peripheral vision that an investment of $1 million plus is going to be required to go to a sustainably higher level of production, many of them just take on a strange form of denial. They start looking to solve other, more affordable problems, never facing up to the true cost of fixing the problem. They'll say things like, if I could just get my staff to work together a little bit better, if they would just try a little harder. Yes, those things would be nice, but they wouldn't lift the practice to the superstar level. All right, finally, let's talk about team productivity and its impact on profit. You see, once you've laid down hard-earned money for marketing and you've managed to miraculously bring in a few more new patients each month, the staff have to pick up the challenge if you're going to see the bottom line of the practice improve. At this point, if they're not motivated or incentivized by the bonus, you are in trouble from a profit standpoint. I've watched doctors who've gotten bogged down in their efforts to get the bonus up and running. Some of them finally give up and just try to fix their productivity challenge by hiring more staff. Unfortunately, it doesn't work. The more people you hire, the more people you have to train, supervise, and encourage to get along with one another. Of course, that's the great challenge, isn't it? The superstar practices have just enough staff with the addition of a bullpen employee or two, depending on the size of the practice. There is not a single superstar practice that is inhabited by a gang of clock-punching bureaucrats. When a doctor utters these fatal words and says, "My team are not incentivized or motivated by the bonus," whether they realize it or not, they've pronounced a death sentence on their bottom line, that is, on the profit. See, when staff are motivated, they're more likely to innovate. They begin solving problems that make it possible for them to accomplish more and to do it without going on a hiring spree. Adding staff to a clinic brings a version of the same challenge that adding an associate doctor brings. You have to have a strong team to add more employees or an associate doctor. If you can't honestly answer that your team is on fire for growth, you're looking right down the barrel of profit displacement syndrome. All right, I think you've got the big idea about the many dangers of this silent practice killer, displacement, and its three forms: new patient displacement, production displacement, and profit displacement. All right, let's go on to our next question. Greg, I've heard that you're not high on pension plans for employees. Is that true? And if so, how can I compete with other employers who offer this type of employee benefit? Doctor, I'm glad you've asked this question because I want to clear this up. It isn't the first time we've heard this. Our objection to pension plans has nothing to do with them being inherently evil. It has to do with a mindset that's proven to be the downfall of an impressive number of our doctors. I'm talking about the use of pensions or other forms of tax-deferred savings as an out-and-out effort to avoid income tax. If you want to contribute to a tax-deferred retirement plan for yourself or your employees, then you and I are on the same page. On the other hand, if you've been told by your accountant that you'll never have to contribute to your employees' pension because they tend to come and go before they achieve a serious vesting, then you're in for a disappointment. In other words, if you intend to use your retirement plan to avoid or substantially lower your income taxes in the long run, I don't think you're going to like the outcome. See, here's the problem. It only takes between one and two vested employees. That means that they have enough vested in their name. They could keep it, in other words, if they leave. You only have to have one or two of these vested employees in your pension to typically nullify the long-term tax benefit of the doctor's portion of the contribution. Typically, that's about 12% of your total pension contribution. If you're contributing $20,000 a year to a qualified pension, and more than $2,400 of the money ends up going to someone other than yourself, you can bet that you would have done just as well or better putting that same amount of money after tax into municipal bonds, meaning, of course, you would have had less to invest, but you're still as well off or better. So no, we're not against pensions. We're against the way they're often used. In the accounting world, there's a school of thought, and it's not the only school of thought, but there's one that states that all taxes are better off paid at a later date. In the world of multi-million-dollar corporate finance, well, that may be true. I don't know about that world. In the collections of a few million dollars a year at best world of professional practice, I feel that this pay-it-later rule doesn't always apply. In fact, it seldom applies. The cost of paying taxes at a later date has, to date, cost our doctors more than it saved them. If you feel you need to offer a pension plan or health benefits to attract effective workers so that you can compete with bigger employers, then by all means do so. It's just one more cost of doing business if you have to do that. I would caution, however, that if you do decide to start a qualified pension plan, that you use it as a true retirement vehicle as opposed to a tax dodging or tax deferring device. Don't attempt to stuff large, unjustified sums of money into pension plans. It tends to backfire in the end. All right, next. Doctor asks, I've followed your advice for years about buying municipal bonds. My financial advisor says that I should consider diversifying my portfolio to add the upside potential that stocks can bring. I've been told that I can control the risks associated with stocks by simply holding on to these stocks until they recover in the event that the ones that I choose do go down. Greg, what do you think? Doctor, keep in mind that you could actually have some upside potential in municipal bonds. That's right, you could choose to sell them if interest rates were to go down. See, if interest rates go down, your municipal bond resale values actually go up. So if it's just some upside potential you're looking for, you may already have it right there in your municipal bond portfolio. But from the standpoint of pure simplicity, bonds couldn't be easier to work with. See, interest rates either go up or they go down. Yes, the number of factors that can cause interest rates to fluctuate are almost endless. But the fact remains, they either go up or down. With bonds, if you do lose and interest rates go up, making your bonds less valuable in the resale market, you can choose to hold them until they mature. On the other hand, if you bury a good chunk of your retirement savings in equities like stocks or mutual funds, there's really no end in sight. Whoever told you that just holding on to bad stocks is an investment strategy hasn't read Warren Buffett or Peter Lynch. Warren Buffett says that if you want to buy and hold stocks as your personal investment strategy, you better have selected a buy and hold portfolio. That means you have to buy stocks that are undervalued to begin with. If you buy overpriced stocks, the great man himself says that time isn't on your side. If you're going to play the equity game, you need to learn some of the basic rules. All right, first, you make money when you buy stocks, not when you sell them. That means that you have to buy fairly or underpriced stocks if you want to play the I'm in this for the long run game. Underpriced is a factor of the price to earnings ratios. Normal is defined as $1 of net corporate earnings to $14 of the price paid for stock. When Krispy Kreme donut stock was hot, it was priced at 91 times earnings or 91 to 1. That's right, it was way overpriced. That's fine as long as there's some great story that explains why, in truth, that's really cheap, you know, in light of some recent discovery that will make the price go even higher. At the height of the tech run-up in 1999, software stocks, you know, were the hottest thing going. They were priced at 421 times earnings. That's right, it had a long way to fall, and yes, fall it did. And communication stocks during this same period of time were not far behind, priced at 126 times earnings. The wreckage from these overpriced tech stocks is still washing up on the portfolio shores of many ill-fated investors, many of them my clients. Keep all of this in mind as you contemplate the leap into an investment world that you may not completely understand. See, unfortunately, underpriced stocks are harder and harder to find as the digital information world makes today's equity markets hyper-efficient, as Warren Buffett puts it. That means that any information about a stock that could benefit an investor is instantly available to millions of other investors all at the same time. And many of their computers and their brokers' computers are fine-tuned to notify them of just such breaking information. Warren Buffett recommends that the clueless, you and I, and the financially uninitiated, stay with equity-indexed products, namely mutual funds that are diversified in such a way as to reflect the movements of the stock market as a whole. So, is there any danger for the equity investor that takes this advice and buys indexed funds? There are a few concerns that you might want to keep in mind. First, is the market as a whole already overpriced? See, if it's overpriced, even an index will only ensure that your investment sinks at the same smooth rate over time that the rest of the market does. Second, is there a risk that an event like terrorism could negatively affect your investment? This would be a special concern if you were about to need this money. You know, you wanted to withdraw it for your retirement. Are the demographics of the country such that there could be a mass exodus from stocks as aging baby boomers exit the market? I received an article just yesterday by one of our longtime brokers, Tom Puentes, talking about the current market jitters arising out of this very concern. I think the question I'd like to ask any doctor thinking they need to leave the safety of bonds to go into today's equity markets is, do you really feel like you need this? In other words, do you need the additional gains that badly? I would also ask, if you were rich by your own definition, would you buy bonds or would you buy stocks? In other words, if you had plenty of money, would you put it at risk? At our last marketing seminar, transition specialist Jack Flynn got up and told our doctors how they could predictably sell their practices for 5 times annual earnings. For most of the people in the room, that represented a sales price of over $3 million. This came as a complete surprise to most of the doctors, as they realized for the first time in their lives that by their own definition, they're already rich. If you could get millions for your practice, my question is, would you be betting your retirement savings then on overpriced stocks? Let's face it, if you were in this position and then you lost all that money, you'd never forgive yourself. I found that when doctors talk about their tolerance for risk, it's completely different than talking about having lost money. I say this because everyone I talk to tells me that they have a high tolerance for risk, but when they ask them how they would feel if they lost half their savings, they tell me then that they have no tolerance for losing money. They only have tolerance for risk. See, there's no connection between the risk tolerance and the tolerance for actually losing money. So, is the current market overpriced? I've heard a great deal of talk lately that many investors are losing hope or about to in any foreseeable market recovery. If that's the case, and you bought equities, you could be in for a bit of a downturn that could easily last longer than you can. So, doctor, I'd suggest that you listen to your broker, but you make your own decisions based on some of those questions that I asked about how you'd feel if you lost a good portion of your life savings right about the time you need the money for retirement. I know. Seems like I'm always raining on the equity parade, but hey, somebody's got to do it. Doctor, be careful. Thanks for listening.